Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's very nice to see you all here. I have great honour and privilege to introduce actually a pin-up of mine. I've always admired what Chris has done, and Chris has been leading the way in the field of public procurement, making public procurement a sexy and exciting subject, which I have convinced the LLM students of. And he is very much a lead in that field, but actually he's moving much more into the field of human rights, and he's got the world's best job in academia. He's got a 3-year leading fellowship on the integrated theory of comparative human rights law.
Very good.
And he's going to be talking about an aspect of that statement. It's fantastic to have him here. The floor is yours. Talk for about 40 minutes and answer some questions.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. Not least because my daughter is here, so it's very nice to be able to combine the academic and the personal. So, in an article that some of you may know about in about 2000 in the Oxford Journal of Legal Studies, I talked about that it was becoming commonplace in several jurisdictions for judges to refer to decisions of the courts of foreign jurisdictions when interpreting domestic human rights guarantees, but that it was controversial and there was a question about its appropriateness. So since then, since 2000, this phenomenon of judicial borrowing has become a sort of cottage industry, really, in the academic world, in terms of people writing about it. There's been a lot more research done on it, not least because the US Supreme Court controversies have erupted in the meantime, and that has intensified the debate. So the increased, one of the major benefits, I think, of the fact that it was controversial in the US context has been that there's been an increased, substantially increased amount of research produced on the phenomenon in other contexts as well. And this is not least the case in the context of the European Court of Human Rights and the Court of Justice of the European Union. So there's now a very significant number of scholarly studies that have been conducted on the use of comparative reasoning by each of these courts. Sometimes these studies examine the respective court alone, sometimes comparing the two. So two critical distinctions emerge from this scholarship. The first is between comparative materials drawn on by these courts that derive from what might be called internal sources, and those that derive from external sources. So internal sources are those essentially that relate to those jurisdictions to which the relevant court has direct relevance. So for the European Court of Human Rights, obviously it includes the 47 countries that are parties to the convention. For the Court of Justice, it includes the 27 countries and the domestic and constitutional practices of those countries. So when the Court of Human Rights draws on the legal practices of the 47 in order to determine, for example, whether there's a consensus for the purposes of deciding the margin of appreciation, then it's using internal sources. Similarly, when the Court of Justice draws on the constitutional practice of some or all of the 27 to identify a common constitutional tradition, as it's called, for the purposes of determining whether it's a fundamental right in EU law, then they're using internal sources also. So in contrast, external sources are those that relate to those jurisdictions to which the respective courts do not have direct relevance. So, for example, when the Court of Human Rights or the Court of Justice identify sources from the United States or Canada or Israel or Hungary, as relevant for the interpretation of a particular provision of the convention or EU directives. So that's one distinction between internal and external. The other distinction that arises is between international sources and those that derive from domestic sources. So international sources obviously are those that derive from both hard law sources, such as treaties, but also softer law sources like recommendations from human rights bodies and so on. So when the Court of Human Rights refers to decisions by the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, which it increasingly does, or recommendations by the Venice Commission, which it even more frequently does, or interpretations by the UN Human Rights Committee, then those are references to external sources, to international sources, as well as external. And so too when the Court of Justice and the European Court of Human Rights does much the same thing. So we can see by combining these two sets of distinctions that any particular source may fit into one of four categories. Internal domestic, external domestic, internal international, and external international. Now, you'll forgive me for making these pretty obvious distinctions, but I want to try to make use of these now. For a particular argument, but in order to make the argument, I think the categories need to be understood. So these categories are neither clear-cut nor stable. So for example, until the European Convention was formally recognized by the European Union treaties as directly relevant for the purposes of driving EU fundamental rights, then we might well have thought of the use by the Court of Justice of the Convention for these purposes, as a reference to external international sources. But since the treaties have incorporated the convention, the legal position, therefore, has shifted, and the convention now becomes an internal international source. Yeah? Okay, so the scholarly studies of the use of comparative reasoning by these courts is remarkably consistent in demonstrating that, in all but one respect, the pattern of use of these different sources is relatively similar by the two courts. The most dramatic development, I think, has been the extent to which both the Court of Justice and the Court of Human Rights have become extraordinarily comfortable in their use of each other's case law. And this cross-pollination, I think, is now so common that the participants in the respective systems now seldom think about it. It's done almost automatically. That's not to say that the respective case law of the other court is simply accepted uncritically. It's not, in either case. There are also differences at the margins in the comparative methods adopted. Whatever the differences, the two courts, however, appear to treat each other as effectively internal sources, irrespective of the formal position. In that sense, we see a largely judicially led change in what might be thought of as the rule of recognition of both systems. So too, the Court of Justice and the Court of Human Rights are remarkably similar in the use of their respective internal domestic sources in determining whether a consensus has emerged or a common constitutional tradition is present. Now, again, that's not to say that the use of these comparative materials is unproblematic in these contexts, or that it hasn't been subject to extensive and, I think, probably pretty convincing criticism. It's only to say that the pattern of use by the two courts is relatively similar in all these respects. The similarity in the way that the courts go about the business of doing this comparative work is also quite striking. In the early days, both courts often relied on individual judges' own knowledge or information supplied by one of the parties, or by interveners. Now, both courts have professionalized the comparative research in ways that I think outside people do not necessarily fully comprehend the implications of. And both courts now have research sections within the courts whose task it is to produce the relevant material on which the comparative assessment can be made. As a sort of quasi-practitioner in these contexts, from a common law jurisdiction, of course, this drives advocates berserk, because material is being produced which is not necessarily subject to any scrutiny by the party's lawyers and may not actually emerge until the judgment, which I think is relatively common practice in the civil law, but relatively uncommon practice in the common law. Anyway, all that said, it would be a mistake, I think, to think that this high degree of similarity in the use and production of internal materials carries through in the use of external sources. In particular, the use of external domestic sources, think of the United States Supreme Court as being an external domestic source for both courts, differs markedly between the two courts. The European Court of Human Rights increasingly embraces the use of these external domestic sources, whilst the Court of Justice largely ignores them. So the European Court of Human Rights' use of these external domestic sources is prominently on display in some of the most significant cases of the past decade. I'm not going to list them, but trust me. There are several different features of this use that I think need to be noted. The court does not primarily refer, this is the Court of Human Rights, the court does not primarily refer to these sources for what might be called rhetorical purposes. Right? So lots of courts use foreign judgments for rhetorical purposes because a particular judge used a nice phrase. So the use of foreign sources in these cases contributes directly to the decision in the case, in that it's part of the reasoning that the court sets out as the basis for its decision. And in some cases, it not only contributes to the reasoning, it's the primary reason identified by the court. Now, the jurisdictions from which the court draws these external domestic sources consists of a relatively small group of jurisdictions, mostly the United States, Canada, South Africa, and to a lesser extent, Israel. That is, countries that are Anglophone and or based to some extent on the common law. The Court of Human Rights' pretty warm embrace of these sources also appears to be given increased prominence over the past few years, at least by the Grand Chamber. And this coincides with the increased professionalization of the comparative law research within the court that I mentioned, and the increased use of comparative law arguments by parties and interveners. So now it's not at all uncommon for interveners and the parties to significantly use comparative research of this kind. Contrast this with the approach adopted by the Court of Justice. The court often does refer to those sources for what might be called rhetorical purposes. So it's often by the Advocate General in sort of throwaway, relatively throwaway comments and footnotes. So, for example, when the use of the Dred Scott case is used by one of the Advocates General, that's rhetorical, primarily expressive to make a particular point. Even leaving those instances aside, the use of foreign sources seldom, if ever, contributes directly, apparently at least, to the decision in the case. And so far as I can see, is never the primary reason identified by the court to justify its decision. The jurisdictions from the court draw, from which the court does draw, when it does, is an even smaller group of jurisdictions, primarily the United States. So there's no indication that the use of these sources, that is the external domestic sources, is increasing, despite the increased professionalization of the comparative law function in the court. So there are two caveats that have to be entered to this argument of significant difference in that respect. First, the relative absence of references to external domestic sources that I'm talking about relates to the fundamental rights jurisprudence of the Court of Justice. This is what I'm focusing on, fundamental rights jurisprudence of the court. Not necessarily to jurisprudence arising from the internal market aspects of the court's jurisdiction. There, the use of jurisprudence of the US Supreme Court is by no means the exception. Particularly in the earlier days, I think. And certainly it's pretty well known that the Court of Justice, whether it acknowledged it or not, did have regard to US case law in terms of developing the whole constitutional and internal market dimension because it saw it as part of the United States of Europe. The second major exception to the lack of reference to external domestic sources in the context of rights claims, I think, is the use of United States jurisprudence by the Court of Justice in the interpretation of the anti-discrimination provisions of the treaty and the interpretation of the anti-discrimination directives. But I think it's noteworthy in considering the reasons for the use of the US sources in that context that EU anti-discrimination law is seen, at least to some extent, as deriving from US practice, not least by those lawyers practicing in the area before the court. I think Anthony Lester, who's used US sources prominently in their advocacy before the court in these cases right from the earliest days. It's also noteworthy, I think, that until relatively recently, EU anti-discrimination law was not seen as centrally part of fundamental rights by the court, or indeed by the EU generally, but rather part of social affairs and employment, and to that extent, therefore, perhaps closer to internal market concerns. I know that's changed, but that's an issue I want to come back to. So these differences in the use of comparative reasoning, I suggest, tell us something significant about differences in the underlying theory of human rights that the courts implicitly or explicitly adopt. So in other words, fascinated though I am, as I know you are, by the intricacies of EU and ECHR case law, that isn't the primary point of this exercise. Primary point of the exercise is, what does this different methodological approach tell you about the different theory of human rights that's in play? So to justify that argument, that it does tell you something significant about the theory of human rights that's in play, I think we need to step back a bit from the detail and plunge into some more theoretical issues. Sorry. So I need to make it clear initially what the project is not about. So I mentioned earlier that the last decade has seen a significantly increased research into the phenomenon of comparative reasoning by courts. And numerous examples have been uncovered where the courts in one jurisdiction have examined and cited the approaches adopted in another jurisdiction. This is obviously an increased phenomenon. Now, Jeremy Waldron has just published what might justifiably be considered, I think, the first full-length monographic treatment of judicial borrowing from a jurisprudential perspective. And in a characteristically well-written and ambitious argument, I'm being taped, Jeremy, Waldron is concerned to address the issue of the use of foreign law in American courts. And he considers rightly that the judicial use of foreign law says much about the way in which law develops and is interpreted by courts. His concern is to develop an appropriate jurisprudential response to and justification of this phenomenon. And his argument is briefly that the foreign law used in American judicial settings constitutes jus gentium, that is, positive law grounded in an emerging global consensus. When courts apply this jus gentium, they're applying legal principles that supplement their national legal rules. It's a relatively modest thesis. It appears that Waldron wants to argue only that the jus gentium is legally relevant, constituting legal authority, not a set of legally binding rules. Courts may legitimately take it into account, but there's no obligation on them to do that. It's a legitimate method for them to adopt for two principal reasons. First, because courts can learn from other courts when they address questions that are the same or similar, particularly in terms of the judicial techniques that may be used to solve problems. And secondly, it's relevant because there may be, I'm quoting now, there may be some virtue in sheer consistency across the decisions of different courts, even for courts belonging to different jurisdictions. So there are several aspects of Waldron's book that help to distinguish his project from mine in this paper. Waldron mentions but doesn't primarily concern himself with the phenomenon of judicial borrowing outside the United States. Obviously, I do. I'm primarily concerned with it in the European context. That may be different. Second, Waldron's concerned to develop a general theory that applies to the use of foreign courts in American courts, foreign law in American courts generally, and not primarily in the context of human and constitutional rights, whereas I'm principally concerned with it in terms of human and constitutional rights. And thirdly, his concern is to develop a theory of law, and I'm not. I'm concerned to develop a theory of human rights, and that's again different. So, what do we make of all of this? Well, let's begin with a notion of what we mean by a human rights theory. So, several different methodologies have been proposed to answer the question of how we're to determine what human rights are. So, one approach to the question is descriptive, and the other is normative. Although the distinction is perhaps questionable. Descriptive approach attempts to answer the question by describing, for example, how the terms have come to be used historically or how it may have changed over time. Another type of descriptive approach is the one that lawyers often use. So we say that human rights are those rights designated as such by law, whether domestic law or international law. So contrast that with what I'll call broadly normative approaches to the use of, to the idea of human rights. By this I mean that there's some attempt to reason through to the position that a particular claim is appropriately considered to be a human rights claim from a moral or ethical position. And there are essentially three normative theories currently in competition. You'll realize that I am now treading into extraordinarily controversial territory. Okay. Particularly in saying that there are three theories. Things that always work out as threes, don't you find? Anyway, okay. So the first theory I'll call, and that has been called, a naturalistic approach. And it goes under different names. So sometimes called naturalistic, or sometimes called orthodox, or sometimes it's called traditional approaches, depending on the author. But they all involve attempts to identify a particular norm or value from which human rights are derived, which therefore delimit their scope and application. And these approaches concentrate on the core idea of human rights as those rights that individuals have simply in virtue of their humanity, and attempt to explain and identify what the features of the human person are that generate these kinds of rights. We might say, for example, that human rights are derived from the idea of, pick your favorite one at the moment, the favorite one is human dignity. So naturalistic approaches may be either metaphysical or non-metaphysical. Taking the example of human dignity as quite a good example, some argue that the concept of dignity depends on a metaphysical understanding of the human in relation, for example, to a deity. So man in the image of God would be a classic naturalistic human rights theory. But there are also non-metaphysical understandings of human dignity that are also naturalistic. So where the dignity of the person is seen to derive from an understanding of what it means to be human in an anthropological sense, for example, based on our observations of human experience. Proponents of natural law theories argue that their theories are of this type, that is, non-metaphysical, naturalistic theories. Think John Finnis. So, despite the, I think that isn't an indication of disagreement, he did tell me. I encouraged him to throw his papers down and say, I've never heard so much rubbish, and then leave, right? Just to dramatize. So despite the adoption of such concepts such as human dignity and the rights jurisprudence of both the Court of Justice and the European Court of Human Rights, I think there's little indication, and here I lose half the audience. If they were ever friends, I now lose you. There's little indication that I can see that either court adopts a naturalistic theory of human rights, either metaphysical or non-metaphysical. There's even less evidence that I can see that the reason why either court engages in comparative reasoning is in order to derive evidence from this comparative experience of deeper understandings of what it means to be human. as we'll see, in the few instances where this appears to be the case, these examples are better seen as arising from a different understanding that I'll sketch out. So second possible theory is what's often been called, and these are all set out very elegantly and I think successfully, by Charles Bites in a recent book that if you haven't read, you really should. So an agreement-based understanding of human rights focuses instead on human rights being derived from some degree of consensus or common view of what human rights are, saying, for example, international human rights as properly reflecting the core or basic minimum of that agreement. So at first sight, this kind of agreement-based theory appears to be the best fit for the understanding of human rights to which both the Court of Justice and the Court of Human Rights implicitly subscribes. After all, I've talked about consensus, I've talked about common constitutional principles. And that all sounds very consensus-based, very agreement-based. But my suggestion is that that is not actually what happens. Neither court regards the agreement-based approach as in itself the basis for identifying the scope and application of human rights or their existence. The absence of European consensus does not stand in the way of either court identifying a new human right when it chooses to do that. Indeed, the Court of Human Rights appears on occasion to have used external domestic sources as the basis for reasoning that the European consensus should not determine the outcome of the case. And indeed, there have been dissents on precisely that point. The more fundamental the right, for example, to be free from torture, the less apparent is any resort to the use of consensus. Fortunately, after 9/11. The absence of any need for consent by the relevant parties to international agreements before they're drawn into the interpretive process by the court is another indication that agreement is relevant but by no means determinative for the court. The real nature of the underlying understanding of human rights is therefore, I suspect, unduly obscured by the mismatch between the consensus-type reasoning that the Court of Human Rights uses to explain and justify its decisions and what the court often does in practice. This mismatch is much less pronounced in the Court of Justice, but only because that court and its advocates general are even more reticent in explaining their use of comparative materials. So in other words, there's less of a target for the mismatch. So let's turn to the third competing normative theory of human rights, which is what's sometimes been termed political theory. Unlike those human rights theorists considered to be naturalistic, the political understanding does not derive the meaning or authority of human rights directly from some objective, deeper order of values. Unlike those who base their understanding of human rights on agreement, human rights norms are regarded as serving as much to frame disagreement as agreement. So in a political conception of human rights are seen as essentially political doctrine constructed to play a certain role in political life. So we should, and I'm quoting now, frame our understanding of the idea of human rights by identifying the roles this idea plays within a discursive practice. It is essentially a functional account, but it is a normative account as well. Not just a descriptive account, it's a normative account. So of these three competing theories, my argument is that the political is what seems best to capture the understanding of human rights adopted by both courts. Now, it must be conceded that a significant degree of what I'll call reconstruction is necessary in order to arrive at this conclusion. And this is because neither court's particularly forthcoming in its reasoning. The conclusion that the normative political theory is the best fit for the actual practice of both courts is based on the relatively few occasions when the courts have lifted the veil and allowed us to peek underneath. But based on these, I suggest the view of rights adopted by both courts is that rights are seen as political doctrine constructed to play a certain role in political life. It's noteworthy, I suggest, that the most thorough legal study yet undertaken of the role of comparative reasoning in both courts, a book that came out recently in the Netherlands, identifies what the author calls strategic reasons as the best explanation for the use of such reason. And that seems to be absolutely right. So we've seen that the most significant differences in the use by the Court of Human Rights of external domestic sources is a key difference. But that these are practically absent from the reasoning of the Court of Justice. So we're left with a puzzle. If, as I've argued, is indeed the case, both courts share a broadly political understanding of human rights, why the differences in their practice of comparative reasoning? So how do we explain this difference? And my argument is that the courts in question adopt significantly different understandings of the particular role that rights play in their particular area of European political life. So the differences in the use of comparative reasoning arise from the different approaches the courts take to the different functions of human rights in the political and legal systems within which the courts operate, and the different role of the courts within these systems regarding these rights. So far, I haven't distinguished between constitutional and human rights. So for Rawls, this, of course, would be a major category error. So Rawls says, some think of human rights, some of you, he wrote, as roughly the same rights that citizens have in a reasonable constitutional democratic regime. This view simply expands the class of human rights to include all the rights that liberal governments guarantee. And for Rawls, however, in The Law of Peoples, by contrast, human rights express a special class of urgent rights, such as, and he goes on to list them. For Rawls, then, human rights are distinct from constitutional rights or from the rights of liberal democratic citizenship. So we can see more clearly the relationship between the content of human rights and their function now. So for Rawls, one of the functions of human rights, in this sense, is that when a state accords these human rights, this is sufficient to exclude justified and forceful intervention by other people. For example, by diplomatic or international or economic sanctions, or in grave cases, by military force. And Raz has a very similar understanding, as I understand it, of the nature of international human rights as being essentially those rights that set the very limited conditions under which otherwise unjustified international intervention in another state can be seen to be acceptable. And I'm very skeptical, and I go on at some length as to why I'm skeptical of this conception of human rights in terms of their detail, largely because it seems to me that the difference between constitutional and human rights is exaggerated. However, that said, there is, despite the problematic nature of the distinction, there is a basic intuition that they've identified, which seems to be right. Namely, that rights function differently in different political and legal contexts. That seems to be the essential point that, leave aside the detail, is an important insight. Add to this intuition the issue of the different functions that different types of courts play in different political and legal systems, and we have a recipe for quite distinctive methodologies emerging as to how the same right should be interpreted. The European Court of Human Rights is, quite simply, a court of human rights. The court is primarily interested in the relationship between the individual and the state. Their primary job is not to get the state to work better, or more fairly, or more justly, or more efficiently, or even more democratically, except where an individual's rights are engaged. The court's function is to try to ensure that a particular individual is not being oppressed by the state. My suggestion is that whilst the Court of Human Rights is in some respects and has been called a constitutional court, it's not a constitutional court in the sense that, for example, the United States Supreme Court is thought of as a constitutional court. In contrast, the treaties establishing and maintaining the European Union, even with the addition of the Charter of Fundamental Rights, are not primarily about human rights. The role of the Court of Justice, therefore, is about creating and maintaining a system of economic and, to some extent, political governance, in which human rights play an important part, but only a part. As with the US Supreme Court, the role of the Court of Justice is to interpret the role, the meaning, and the scope of human rights in light of the overall structure and function of the treaties as a whole. treaties have other things to do as well as to protect human rights. So has the Court of Justice. So what I'm suggesting, therefore, is that a political understanding of human rights is convincing, that it emphasizes the need to see the different contexts in which rights are being interpreted as fundamentally important. Now, I'm going to skip a long discussion of Charles Bites, which is fascinating, but not one that I'm going to inflict on you at the moment, and go to the conclusion. Yeah. So how does this help us to understand the differences in the practice of comparative reasoning between the Court of Justice and the Court of Human Rights, particularly the latter's more extensive use of external domestic materials? Mm-hmm. So let me recap on what I've argued so far. So the Court of Human Rights' engagement with external materials is emerging as a regular, if not yet essential, feature of contemporary Court of Human Rights practice, whereas this is not the case with the Court of Justice. Despite sharing a common political theory of human rights, they appear to differ in the function that the respective courts play in the human rights system, with the Court of Justice adopting a more constitutional role, think US Supreme Court, seeing its role as primarily one of engaging with European issues. It is a European political system that's being constructed. The Court of Human Rights, on the other hand, is Janus-faced. On the one hand, like the Court of Justice, it faces inwards, to Europe, obviously. But on the other hand, it faces outwards, seeing itself as engaging in a discourse with the wider world on the nature and limits of human rights, not on the nature and limits of constitutional government, but on the nature of limits of human rights. Unlike the Court of Justice, the European Court of Human Rights sees itself identifying human rights in dialogue with others, and these others are not only Europeans. This is most clearly seen in the cases in which the court engages extensively with international external materials. Here, the court clearly identifies itself as an international as well as a European Court of Human Rights, seeing its role, at least in part, as securing a degree of coherence between the diffuse parts of the human rights system. Indeed, the Court of Human Rights says as much. The court sees human rights in this context from what I'll suggest is a Bitesian perspective. The court wants and perhaps needs to participate in this international cultural practice. Now, that may explain the Court of Justice's extensive use of international legal materials, but what about external domestic materials, such as judgments of the US Supreme Court and the Supreme Court of Israel and so on? So why would the court engage with these? And the answer appears to be because of the complex nature of the cultural practice that the court is engaging in. It's not just an international practice, it's a global or transnational practice, one to which domestic actors significantly contribute. Remember again the extensive nature of the global discursive community in which the court is placed. So the domestic constitutional courts, the external domestic constitutional courts that the Court of Human Rights identifies as its primary interlocutors, are precisely those that are most active in domestic and transnational political networks. US Supreme Court, Canadian Court, South African Court, they're the ones that are primarily involved in transnational political networks with regard to judicial decision-making in the human rights context. The Court of Justice simply does not yet consider itself as part of the global discursive community on human rights. So if this is correct, and this is my last closing point, if this is correct, we then have an important insight into the respective theories of human rights that the court appears to adopt. For the Court of Human Rights, it's a discursive understanding of human rights in which human rights evolve politically through dialogue and conflict with external actors. This is also the case for the Court of Justice, but modified in two critical respects. Human rights are part, but only part, of a system of European governance that must be protected and furthered. And the human rights should emerge from a primarily European discourse in which the states and the Court of Human Rights are the principal actors, insofar as they serve European interests. A rough modus vivendi has thus emerged in which the courts play differing but complementary roles. And the differing roles of different uses of comparative reasoning are an important indicator of these different roles. Now, I've got a further section on the implications of this for the future, in particular the Charter and membership by the Union of the Council of Europe, but I'll leave that for the discussion. Thank you.